Good evening. Welcome, Fellowship Church. I'm Pastor Ken Krause. I'm glad that you're here and you joined us tonight. We're happy to see Dr. John Cooper with us tonight, too. It should be a very engaging and interesting evening. Just to let you know, there are a couple of restrooms over there on that side of the hallway with drinking fountains if you need that. I'm the pastor here at Fellowship Church, but I didn't always want to be a pastor. I, at one time, was an atheist and a searching atheist. I wanted to know if there was more to this life, more to this world than what I was getting. But I was a thinking atheist. I was considered myself a math and science sort of person, and I thought that being a person of faith and being a math and science and a thinking person didn't go together. But thankfully, within time, I discovered the Christian Reformed Church and Calvin Theological Seminary. There, it was okay to ask, and is okay, to ask very deep and hard questions and to think deeply about cultural, philosophical, scientific issues of the day. Professor Cooper was one of my favorite professors. I'm not just saying that because he's here. Yeah, that's right. The grades are already in. He could think deeply, and he could think with logic and with sound reasoning. And even when I found myself disagreeing with him, which I did on occasion, I found myself saying, "I don't agree with that, but tell me more. Tell me more." Because of his engaging style, I wanted to learn more about the subject. And I was eager to learn more and more, and I'm sure you'll experience that part tonight too. Dr. Cooper got his undergraduate degree at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, a Master of Arts, a PhD at Toronto University of Toronto, a Master of Theological Studies at Calvin Theological Seminary. He's taught philosophy at an undergraduate level and currently teaches philosophical theology at Calvin Theological Seminary. He's written numerous books about body and soul dualism, inclusive language for God, panentheism, and many, many more books and articles. We're delighted to have you here, John. Let's give a warm welcome to Dr. John Cooper.
Thank you very much for coming out, sharing my interest in this topic, and for the warm hospitality I've experienced so far. I want to speak tonight on postmodern spirituality. By the way, there are handouts, and if anyone doesn't have one, I think they're available at the back there. I'm going to stick pretty close to the outline, and if I run out of time, I'm simply going to stop where I am. It's one of those kind of lectures. I can keep on going or I can cut it off at any point. Obviously, I'm a committed Christian, but what I'm going to do is present the topic tonight, postmodern spirituality, religion for a new age, from a rather more academic point of view. In other words, I wouldn't be at all have a problem giving this lecture at the university. I'm going to say at the end what I think about contemporary spirituality from a Christian point of view, but I'm not going to presuppose that on the way in. If you look at the outline of the lecture, I want to begin by just speaking about religion and modernism and postmodernism a little bit. I'm aiming this at kind of a college student level, and then end up by speaking about postmodern spirituality. That will be letter D under Roman numeral 1. But then I want to back up a little bit and give a kind of a philosophical account of religion or spirituality in general. I think that humans are religious animals, among other kinds of animals. So humans are religious beings, and we are religious beings even if we're not sort of practicing some spirituality or even if we don't identify with some sort of a religious tradition. And I'll give you reasons why I think that's true. Then on the second page, if we get to it, I'll just catalog the kinds of worldviews there are. Supernaturalist, naturalist, and humanist. In other words, there are a lot of different religions and worldviews and many variations on the same theme down through history and especially in a complex global village. But if you think about it, there aren't that many different kinds. Just like there's a whole lot of trees in the woods, but if a botanist goes in there and starts classifying, there aren't that many classifications. And so, like it or not, we're in one or the other of these kinds of things. And then Roman numeral 4 is just a little bit about religious pluralism, truth, and salvation. John Hick, the philosopher, talks about pluralism and inclusivism and exclusivism. And then I'll end with a kind of a general Christian response to postmodern spirituality. This wouldn't be my particular brand as much as what C.S. Lewis calls mere Christianity. But what does mere Christianity, how would that reflect on or respond to what we call postmodern spirituality? And I've got about maybe 55 more minutes to talk, and then we'll have a Q&A or a discussion. And I'm looking forward to that. So here we go. Religion, modernism, and postmodernism. I'm now going to think historically. As you know, Western civilization was originally mainly Christian after the Roman Empire, right? The Middle Ages, you come to the Renaissance, Reformation. Most of the cultural leaders are Christians. Into the 17th century, there arises something called deism, which is a kind of irrational but common denominator religion. There is a God who's set up the natural order and the moral order, and that God is the God behind Christianity and Judaism and Islam. And so it's not so much that we ought to go for specific religion as this kind of generic deism. And the cultural leaders hold that in the 17th century. There's still a lot of Christians as well, but deists come up, and as you know, the founding fathers, I mean, who signs the Declaration of Independence? Not all Christians. Right? Some Christians, some deists. Tom Paine was a pantheist. They all believe in God, but if you ask them now who God is, you got a dozen different views in 1776. So in that sense, the original American project is not distinctively Christian. It's deist or theist or something like that. But in the 18th century, especially in France, but in England with David Hume, there arises another kind of modern Enlightenment mentality. And that's not one that thinks there's a God behind everything, but that's one that thinks we don't need a God behind everything. So it's French materialism. It's David Hume's skepticism. And so now we don't have nature and nature's God, we just have nature. And so it's the rise of modern science. Modern science displaces religion and even philosophy. The deists thought we could live by philosophy alone, and that we didn't need religion. And so there's a critique of religion. This is Roman. This is number one under A. And this begins already in the 18th century. And Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and the so-called new atheists are still taking this line. Science eliminates the need for God. Belief in God is not only stupid and irrelevant, it's actually pernicious. It undermines human flourishing, and it's best done away with. So that's a kind of a criticism, the modernist criticism of religion. But modernism doesn't cease to have all beliefs whatsoever. Modernism kind of bases its beliefs on science. So it's what science can tell us about the universe, what science can tell us about human nature. And we're not just interested in knowing, we're interested in doing. Because science isn't any good if it just answers a bunch of encyclopedia questions. Science has to be linked up with technology. And so you get the rise of the Industrial Revolution, and you get machinery. And science needs to be linked to economics. You don't just let people run around and trade and farm and things like this. We have to put our scientific mentality to economics. And Adam Smith does that, and we get the rise of capitalism rationalized. Karl Marx does that, and we get science placed in economics, but with quite a different view. They both share the same view that science and technology hooked up with economics properly is going to bring in utopia. Marx dedicated Das Kapital to Adam Smith. Same worldview, same view of human nature, just a difference of opinion about the role of government in the economy. That's the only difference between them. So there is a faith. Modernism is the faith in science and technology and economics to optimize human life. And I think there are still a bunch of modernists running around. It's not like Christianity ceased to exist when deism came along, and deism ceased to exist when scientific materialism came along, and or modernism, and that modernism ceased to exist when postmodernism came along. In fact, in a complex pluralistic society, we still have lots of Christians, lots of deists, lots of modernists, and lots of postmodernists as well, right? I mean, it's a circus. There's all these different views out there, and we all know these views are all out there. Okay, but in the 20th century now, modernism really does undermine itself, this faith in science and technology to bring in utopia. It undermines itself intellectually because science can't justify the claim that science is capable of bringing in utopia, and science can tell us all the truth. I mean, you get a bunch of philosophy and science that happens in the 20th century to undermine modernism intellectually. But the real undermining of modernism was two world wars, a series of depressions, genocide, the atomic bomb, and now the threat of universal ecological destruction that we all live, you know, whether you believe in global warming or not. The fact is the environment is vulnerable, and an awful lot of the technology to support the lifestyle that's been generated by modernism threatens that. So there's a variety of movements, existentialism, and these different things that come up in the 20th century that displace modernism, if modernism is a faith in science and technology and economics to optimize human existence. And so postmodernism, I'm coming to letter C now, is just the rejection of universal truth claims made by religions or by secular worldviews. To quote one French philosopher, there are no true meta-narratives. A meta-narrative is a worldview. It's a system of truth. So Christianity would be a meta-narrative, and deism would be a meta-narrative, and scientific humanism would be a meta-narrative, and Marxism would be a meta-narrative. These are all worldviews, believed systems, that claim there's one and only one truth. And if you live in terms of that truth, you'll flourish. And if you don't live in terms of that truth, it's downhill. Postmodernism is simply the rejection of that view. So it's the rejection of any absolute system. It's the rejection of any ultimate truth, that there's one way that reality is, and there's one way that humans ought to live to flourish. And so what you're left with is a kind of a collage, kind of worldview pluralism, lifestyle pluralism, religious pluralism, political pluralism. The fact that there's all this pluralism in every dimension of human life, that's what we mean by postmodernism. And then the question is, well, how do we manage this? Since an awful lot of life in the global village depends on our having some uniformity. I mean, you know, we've got to all run by the same computer system. We've got to, you know, have standardized time zones, international currencies. There's got to be rules and regulations for us to all live together. How can we bring together, and there's no meta-narrative now, what's the basis for this kind of universal system that we all have to have in order to make all of this diversity possible? And that's the conundrum of postmodernism. So postmodernism is the rejection of universal truth claims, number one. So number two, it's openness to various worldviews or meta-narratives. Postmodernism is friendly to religion. Modernism was hostile to religion. Postmodernism says, oh, you're a Hindu? That's cool. Well, I'm a New Ager. Are you a Christian? Tell me your story. Oh, I'm not. I don't, but it works for you. It doesn't work for me. Everybody's okay. My worldview is okay. Your worldview is okay. Just let's share. It's neat. It makes us really feel good when we get together and just share instead of fighting. Isn't that cool? And that's kind of like the ethos that we all want in postmodernism. So postmodernism three is both hopeful and pessimistic agnosticism about a future great society. People, we hope for the best, but how do we know we're going to get the best? And by what standard will we get the best? You know, if we go with liberal politics, are we going to get the best? If we go with conservative politics, if we go with religion, if we go with irreligion, people just don't know. If you don't have a meta-narrative, if you don't have an overall worldview, an overall belief system, you can't tell whether we're going to flourish or whether we're not going to flourish. Is this just halftime of America's existence and it's going to be even better the next 200 years? Well, I don't know. Beethoven and the Romantics were real positive about the future. They still do Beethoven's Ninth Symphony on New Year's Day in all the European capitals. They're still hopeful about that. On the other hand, Nietzsche was also a kind of a worldview guy, and Nietzsche was pessimistic about the future. So we don't know whether to be pessimistic or not. But the optimism that the kingdom of God is coming, or das tausend Jahre Reich, or the great society, or communist society, that talk is all done. Very few humans are rationally optimistic about the future. I'm just really sure, on rational grounds, that the future is going to be much better than the past. That's done. That's done. Four, lifestyle. What is the postmodern lifestyle? Well, it's very individualistic, you see. We all want it our way. I got my worldview. I got my preferences. I got my lifestyle. I got my pleasures. And you got yours, and that's cool. The world should be such that we all get just exactly what we want the way we want it. You know, it's not just McDonald's. It's reality. Have it your way. And so postmodernism is very much individualist. It's self-determining. I want to decide about my life. I want to decide about religion. This is sort of essentially human in a way, but it's exacerbated in postmodern culture. There's something very narcissistic. Everybody gets a happy face, and that's got to be ultimate reality. I've already mentioned hedonism. I mean, the most important thing in postmodern culture is that everybody feel good. God exists to make us feel good. Church exists to make us feel good. Other people exist to make us feel good. Our parents exist to make us feel good. Sex exists to make us feel good. Drugs exist to make us feel good. That's what makes the world go round. In a nutshell, the philosopher Foucault said, I desire, therefore I am. You remember, Descartes was the French philosopher who said, I think, therefore I am. That's rationalism. Foucault says, humbug. I desire, therefore I am. And he constructed his philosophy on that basis. So it's not just me, you know, a little out of hat air. Foucault is a pretty standard postmodern philosopher. This culture is very pragmatistic. You do what it takes to get what you want, and that justifies it. Huh? The end justifies the means. What's true? Whatever works. The beliefs work, they're true. The lifestyle works, it's true. There's no such thing as objective truth. How do you tell it's true? Whether it's working for you or not. And it's quite consumerist, too. But five, can't we all just get along? I mean, we're not just selfish here because we want it all ourselves, but we want everybody else to have it too. Right? We should have the global village in which everybody, we all just get along and we all just love one another, but everybody just gets what they want. Isn't that the ideal? Isn't that why the United Nations exists? I mean, isn't that? There's a problem, and I've already identified it, I think, that the common truths, values, rules, and practices that are necessary for a diverse society, I mean, there's got to be some platform, some structure in terms of which we can have all these differences and yet live harmoniously and not in tension or at war with one another. That's going to take a certain amount of rules and truths and values and commitments not only, but then we're going to have to stick to them. And good luck with that, human race. We can't figure out how to fix, you know, our debt in Washington. The Europeans can't figure. They can't agree. And even if they did agree, the poor Greeks couldn't live up to it if they wanted to. So, I mean, this is, afraid I'm not just making this up. Everybody knows that what I'm talking about is pretty much in the air that we breathe. And this collectively is called what we call postmodernism. Postmodernism is nothing positive. It's not like there's a creed, because that would be a narrative. It's just this hodgepodge of all the pluralism of that human beings have and aspired for, all sort of tossed together, and that's collectively postmodernism. It can't stand on its own, and that's why postmodernists are, you know, they're neo-naturalists and neo-romantics and neo-pragmatists and neo-Marxists, all the different philosophies, and traditional religions continue to exist, even with a postmodern kind of dynamic, because postmodernism by itself is not a worldview. It's not a creed by which you can live. It's just like there isn't any creed, so just kind of make it up as you go along is what it really feels like. Okay, well, D, postmodern spirituality then. What is spirituality like in this sort of postmodern culture? It's definitely spirituality against religion. If you identify religion as a kind of an established traditional thing, with churches and mosques and synagogues and doctrinal systems and moral systems and ritual systems and worship systems and organizations and popes and deacons and all that other kind of stuff, people don't want that. They don't want that. They want free. Or if they want it, it's up to them whether they want it or not and what parts of it they want. But people really like to have spirituality. They want authentic spiritual existence. They want something that's genuinely relevant to themselves, that's exciting, that's engaging. And there are nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with these desires. But they typically don't find it or don't think it is to be had in the traditional religions. And so young people, even Christian young people, well, I love Jesus, but I don't go to church. Or, yeah, I'm spiritual. I meditate and I read Khalil Gibran and stuff like this, but I don't identify with any particular religion. So spirituality versus religion is very much a characteristic of postmodern spirituality. It's a desire for openness and authentic experience, for relevance and community. If you get together with other people, this has to be lively, and it's kind of like your friends, and it's spontaneous, and it's not restrictive. You got to join a church, and you know, or join the mosque or something like this. It's all kinds of, and then you're with a bunch of people you don't know and care about, and we don't want to do that. We want to be with our friends and kindred spirits where there's bondedness and everything. Well, there's something healthy about that, but that is set over against the fixed traditional belief systems, institutions, rituals, and lifestyles. Secondly, postmodern spirituality is going to be eclectic and personalized. I mean, if this is the way life is, have it your way, then that's what you're going to do with your spirituality as well. I mean, if you want to practice for a while and then give it up, that's up to you. So people typically are spiritual just the way they want to be. And so it's very eclectic. I can believe this, or I got this idea from this religion and that practice from that religion and some other lifestyle issue from the other one, and I just kind of put them together, and we'll call this Cooperism. It's not Lutheranism or Calvinism, it's Cooperism. And this is kind of Cooper's religion. He kind of just kind of made it up himself, like his own pizza toppings or hamburger toppings or something like this. And folks take this attitude towards spirituality in general and religion in particular, even when they come back to a traditional church. Postmodern Catholics can take or leave the Pope. They can take or leave contraception. They can take or leave the doctrine of transubstantiation. You go there and somehow the ritual makes you feel good and you feel, you know, this is really holy or this is really exhilarating, and it's mainly a feeling, and the words and the doctrines aren't that important, but somehow the ritual and the ambiance is just sort of uplifting, and that's what's really important about the stuff. So when younger people go back to synagogue, Or my daughter had a very good friend in college who was a Muslim from a Muslim country, but had lived in Canada for a while and was very postmodern and kind of reappropriated his own version of Islam. The mullahs would not have been pleased. But that's what this guy was. He was kind of his own Muslim. He didn't get to pick or choose what in Islam he believed or not. And it was very definitely a blend of Islam and postmodernism and religious freedom and all that other kind of stuff. So three, there's surely a diversity of beliefs and spiritual practices and worship styles and lifestyles and views of salvation. It's postmodern spirituality is a collage, and people don't care if they have one belief that contradicts another belief or if they have practices that contradict their beliefs, because logic and consistency and things like this are just those sort of old traditional values that we don't need to worry about necessarily either. So it's very much, it's almost like abstract art in a certain way, or it's like a collage put together, doesn't necessarily have a structure and a coherence to it. That's quite characteristic of an awful lot of postmodern spirituality. And so then those forms of spirituality which exacerbate this, I mean, I think of the New Age movement in the 1980s and 90s, that's kind of heading for the spiritual old person's home now too in some ways. But that attitude, it was very attractive. You know, there's some kind of a transcendental spirit, and we're all part of it, but, you know, it was right brain and associational, and doctrine is a bad thing, and structured lifestyles are a bad thing, but you could have all this kind of spirituality, and you put three New Agers together in a room, and you ask them a proposition, and you'd get, an agnostic and an affirmer and a denier of the same proposition about their own real, but they were all New Agers. And this is great. So you just get together and sort of, meditate about things or cooperate in things, but you don't have to share any beliefs or any moral principles or anything like that. Those sorts of lifestyles or those sorts of spiritual practices have proliferated in the postmodern period. There's a diversity of social forms, too. I mean, some folks just kind of are spiritual individually, or they're spiritual with close friends or significant others or something like this. Or there may be small groups or mega churches. The whole spectrum of sizes of social institutions and kinds of social organization are part of the postmodern collage as well. And that just depends on what you prefer or what you like. And the last point about the postmodern spirituality is that the lifestyle is guided more by values such as love, justice, and well-being rather than specific rules. I mean, if love and justice and freedom are values, then you might, sexual practices that you might get into with another consenting adult would be fine, provided you don't violate those values. But commandments like sex belongs within marriage, or sex shouldn't be done in this circumstance or with that kind of, that really doesn't count. So there are values rather than rules in postmodern ethics. So those are some characteristics of postmodern spirituality, whether it is going back to a traditional religion like Christianity or Judaism or neo-paganism. In a lot of ways, the New Age movement was neo-paganism. And some of it is kind of a nature mysticism like the Native Americans might have had. Other forms of the New Age movement were very North American or Western cultural appropriations of Asian religions like, Buddhism or Hinduism, transcendental meditation, that sort of thing. But I promise you, the way that they were practiced in San Francisco was nothing like the way the gurus actually disciplined themselves in India or Tibet or anything like that. This was just bogus. The real practitioners, because, of course, the way we appropriate it is in terms of a kind of a narcissism. If the Hindu belief is there's an absolute ego, which manifests itself in everything, that's quite different than thinking that the absolute ego that manifests itself in everything is you, the way Shirley MacLaine would sort of articulate her version of the New Age movement. It's a very postmodern appropriation of Asian religion or neo-paganism, Wicca, that sort of thing. It's all within the purview of what I'm talking about. Okay, that is my spiel on religion and modernism and postmodernism, and so postmodern spirituality. But what I want to do in Roman numeral 2 here is to make the philosophical argument that spirituality or religion, in some sense, is a universal feature in human nature. It's part of human nature, okay? Humans are spiritual animals. And I'm not begging the question about the existence of God or the truth of Christianity, because there are many sociobiologists who don't believe in God, who think that humans are essentially and necessarily religious, because it's somehow in our genes, in the process of human evolution, which God had nothing to do with. Those humans who were spiritual or religious evolved and were more successful adapters than those humans who weren't. And somehow this behavior, like lots of other behaviors, got genetically internalized. And so it's not mere culture, mere socialization, there's actually a biological basis for religion. I mean, I don't know that all biologists hold this, but certainly some biologists and some geneticists hold this sort of thing. It's an argument against God's existence. Why is religion and spirituality universal, but we don't need God? Well, because it's just part of evolution. Richard Dawkins likes that argument. Christopher Hitchens likes that argument. So I'm not begging the question about God's existence or the truth of Christianity. I just want to say, with those philosophers and with, say, French nihilistic existentialists, Sartre would not disagree with anything that I've got to say. Sartre was an atheist, but he also thought that humans just needed, as it were, to create for themselves worldviews that they believed in, because they couldn't stand to face the fact that there just wasn't anything that gave life meaning or structure or value. So what I'm saying, let me say it again. I'm not saying this only because I'm a Christian, and I'm not saying it to justify. Of course I'm a Christian, and of course I'm going to come out with my Christian view of this. But what I'm saying is also held by atheistic sociobiologists and French atheistic existentialists. Okay, so it's at least a kind of an on a level philosophical playing field here. I'm going to make the claim, A, that all humans have basic existential needs and ask basic existential questions, the so-called perennial questions. Is there a meaning to life? What is it? How would I go about realizing that meaning of life? Does God exist? Is there objective truth? Is there an afterlife? These are the perennial questions asked by the Greek philosophers. Huxley, in his book, coined the term the perennial questions. Any philosophy textbook is going to talk about these questions. These are questions that humans worry about, not just philosophers, ordinary folks, children, adolescents wonder about these questions. Humans also have basic needs, the need for subsistence, the need for security, the need for some kind of companionship, the need to be valued, the need to have some kind of a sense of meaning and direction in life. You'd like to have a good death rather than bad death. Humans have some basic needs, and once again, these aren't just needs that academics identify, existential psychologists or something like that. These are the felt needs of practically all human beings, right? So human beings have these basic needs, and they have these perennial questions. And this is a universal human condition. Now, I'm thinking that spirituality and religion is whatever people do. in order to answer the questions about how their basic needs are going to get met. And of course, one strategy is just to be an agnostic, or just to ignore these questions. But even that turns out to be a life strategy. You're betting your life on the fact that you can just, do the hedonistic thing and get away with it and sort of postpone the questions until you get older or start to get a terminal disease or something like that. But so even that, even agnosticism or even suppressing the questions, avoiding the questions, failing, or refusing to face up to the questions is itself a kind of spirituality. It generates a lifestyle. It's also faith-based. Those are all characteristics that I think are universally acknowledged to be characteristics of religion. So, A, all humans have basic existential needs and ask basic existential questions. B, all humans live by faith-based worldviews, more or less articulated. Philosophers and theologians and maybe well-educated, reflective people articulate their worldviews really well. But folks who are not very well-educated at all, folks who live in non-Western, highly developed civilization, so people who live in tribal kinds of cultures, and people who live in very practical cultures where you know how to do many things and you're successful in your lifestyle, but you don't have formal education. Those folks also live by worldviews. They've got a picture. Now, let me describe what a worldview is. So I'm not saying that they're all equally well articulated, but I think they're equally present and operative. Listen to what I think a worldview is. I just think a worldview is a set of beliefs about human life and about how it fits into the world and whatever else there is besides the world, if there is something besides the world, and then how to live in terms of whatever else there is. If there are gods, how do you deal with them? If there aren't gods and there's just nature and the cosmos, how do you deal with that? If the universe is basically friendly, fine. If it's basically hostile and you're on your own, how do you deal with it? These are life projects. We don't know how things ultimately are. You can't prove Christianity or Islam or atheism or Marxism or anything else. You can't prove scientific humanism. In the end, all worldviews, whether they're well articulated or whether they're very simple and not very well articulated, are faith-based simply because they can't be rationally demonstrated or verified. Agnosticism, that's a fallback position, but it also has got a pretty strong faith in your own judgment. My own feelings, life experiences, and how I rationalize those things, that's going to be the ultimate criterion by which I make judgments about what there else there is and about how I'm going to live my life. So it turns out that agnosticism is just a kind of ultimate trust in your own judgment. It's not the really rational position to take because, of course, we don't have enough information to tell which worldview is true. It's just another worldview. It's the worldview from inside your little head. And why suppose that that is accurate with respect to ultimate reality? Anyway. So, everybody's got faith-based worldviews. And they live in terms of them, about how to live in order to maximize the good life, whatever that is. Maybe it's pleasing Jesus. Maybe it's getting all the gusto you can get because you only go around once. You define the good life any way you please. Everybody's into that. How to minimize suffering and evil. And of course, if you're a masochist, then that's just a different definition of the good life, isn't it? So that doesn't generate a contradiction. How to die well. Often the choice of suicide is a choice of lesser evils, huh? I can't stand the pain anymore. I'd rather be dead and take a chance on whatever that means than continue to live this way. We all want a good death rather than a bad death. And of course, perhaps, there's something to the afterlife. A worldview doesn't entail an afterlife, not even all religions. There are lots of religions that don't believe in a personal afterlife. There are religions that don't believe in a personal God, so we can't be defining religion that way. There are lots of religions that don't involve prayer or anything like that. So the idea that religion, oh, well, that's about God and prayer and sin and the afterlife. Well, it doesn't even describe standard Buddhism. And if Buddhism is a world religion, then we've got a world religion that doesn't have a personal God, and it doesn't really have, it's got meditation, but not prayer. And the status of the afterlife is really quite unclear. So I'm thinking that religions are bigger than simply beliefs in the supernatural. I'll come to the different kinds of religious worldviews that there are perhaps in a little while if I have time. So all humans have these kinds of faith-based worldviews. There are traditional religions. There are secular worldviews. I'm thinking that modern humanism and communism and all sorts of things like that are faith-based worldviews. They have pictures of reality that don't include God. They picture human life within a certain sort of political and economic sort of dynamics. They have a view of the good life. They have moral rules and all sorts of things, and of course they're faith-based. I mean, Karl Marx didn't think it was faith-based. He thought he could prove this with the science of history, but we're smarter than that now. We know. So Marxism is faith-based, and secular humanism is faith-based, and all that, and these are worldviews. You've got personal worldviews, the ones that folks just kind of make up for themselves. They went to Sunday school and then read some mystical poetry, and they sort of crib it together, and that's their worldview. And then, of course, there are folks who just engage in the ongoing search because they're smart. You know, this doesn't work, and that doesn't work, and I can't quite believe this, and I can't quite believe that, but this doesn't undercut my theory. This just makes the existential quest really poignant. I haven't yet found a worldview that I can trust and base my life on. I'm still looking. So I'm not saying there aren't seekers, and some folks end up seekers all their lives, but even the seeking is a kind of a worldview, if you think about it. So anyway, see, worldviews have what let's call an existential ground. I'm not going to say a God-shaped void. I'm not going to say anything like that, which prejudice is in favor of one or the other. But people, in all worldviews, there are sort of things that function existentially as rock bottom. This is what is ultimate. This is what structures reality. This is what supports human life. And if I just learn to go with the flow this way, then I'm going to get the best life that I can. But if I go against that flow, I'm not going to get the best life that I can. All worldviews have something like that, or maybe more than one thing, okay? Maybe polytheism is possible. Maybe worshiping God and mammon is at least an existential possibility for people, and not just worshiping one thing. But in all worldviews, there's this kind of ultimate. I mean, is it a God? Is it the Big Bang? And then kind of the evolutionary dynamics of the universe? Is it the fact that human beings both create the chains of their enslavement, but also the ability to liberate themselves from those chains? That would be Marxism. And so there's a kind of a trust in human power there. And a whole worldview is based on that. So all humans are looking for some existential ground. Most human worldviews have something like an existential ground in it. And that's kind of the rock bottom in terms of which everything else is deployed and built. And so life is structured. That's the thing which supports life and makes human flourishing possible, because we're all about wanting to flourish, wanting to be good and not bad. That's the human project, whether God exists or not. And here I'll just refer to Paul Tillich's idea of ultimate concern. He was a philosopher of religion, a philosophical theologian. sort of a, he was a very liberal Christian, but I think he's right about this kind of ultimate concern. He's kind of an existentialist in a way, and he says, yeah, this is what human nature is like. And he, of course, applied this to the Nazis in the Second World War. You know, God is an ultimate concern in Christianity and Judaism. But you know what? Nazism, nationalism, Aryan nationalism, with Hitler at the head of it, became the ultimate concern for the Nazis. And it started the Second World War, and it killed millions and millions of people. And that's how Paul Tillich applied his notion of ultimate concern, and he took it away from a traditional religion, and he defined a contemporary atheistic secular ideology as an ultimate concern and a lifestyle. And then he said, yeah, in history, people have complained about how religion kills so many people. But Paul Tillich was kind of angry because in the 20th century, between the Nazis and the communists, they killed more people than most of the wars of religion in all of previous history. I'm not letting the traditional religions off the hook, or Christianity for the Crusades or Inquisition or anything like that. But the claim of Christopher Hitchens and people that religion is bad and it kills people, whereas atheism would probably be a much more beneficial thing to human existence. I don't know what history books he failed to read, but that doesn't turn out to be an empirically true claim at all. Atheists are, on average, at least as abusive and hateful as religious beings. And maybe some atheists are good, too. I don't know that the categories just line up quite so easily. So D here, I think that spirituality or religion is the intentional cultivation of one's life in terms of the worldview based on this ground. Okay, and I'm going to concede right away that many people don't practice or practice consistently spirituality or religion. In other words, we talk about non-practicing Christians, non-practicing Catholics, non-practicing, well, there are non-practicing communists too. Those are the people who, because they're in the head of the Politburo, get to drive the nice cars, drink the nice scotch, live in the nice houses, and wear the nice suits. Mao Zedong was smarter than that. He wore the same clothes as everybody else. Although I bet you the quality of the cloth was a whole lot better, even though the style wasn't any different. Look at the head of the Communist Party in North Korea. All the pigs are equal, right? I don't think so. So there are non-practicing everythings out there. But I'm talking, what I mean by, I'm saying that everybody has got this need and some kind of an inchoate worldview or religion or spirituality. But what we mean by religious or spiritual people are people who really cultivate this, okay? I mean, I'm a Christian and I want to develop my Christianity. I'm a communist and I want to develop my communism. I'm a Hugh Hefner hedonist and I want to develop that. Yeah, wow, there's a popular religion for you. He wrote a 150-page book, which is an intellectual justification of his lifestyle. No pictures in it either, by the way. So, and what does spirituality involve? Well, it's going to involve all the same things as traditional religion. Because, number one, all of these worldviews are faith-based. I've already made that point. And it's not just intellectual assent. Oh, yeah, I think that's true. Like, I think the Red Wings are having a good season. Or you got hockey here in Big Rapids, too, don't you? How about that? Yeah, oh, I know. We in Grand Rapids have heard about the Ferris hockey team. And congratulations, by the way. That's great. Can't have everything in Grand Rapids. Sorry. Let's stay away from that. That's very unpostmodern. That's very tribalistic, isn't it? Okay. But I mean faith in the sense of existential trust. I'm willing to walk on that thin ice because I think it's thick enough to hold me up. I'm willing to devote my life to that ideology. I'm willing to devote my life to that God. I'm willing to devote my life to that scientific principle of let's say about a culture and sociology based on biological evolution. That would be the best. kind of morality and social system. And folks are surely working on that sort of thing. So faith. So everybody's got faith. You know, not just Martin Luther, not just... Yeah, everybody's got that kind of faith. Everybody worships. Not in the sense that they go to church and do rituals, but Bertrand Russell, a free man's worship. He worships the universe. He worships the power of humans to do science and understand themselves and at least make this a better world, even though we all die in it and go into a black hole. He worships it. You worship the power of humans to develop communist society. You worship Der Führer. You worship the almighty dollar. You worship the power of sexuality or whatever gives you pleasure. Worship is just acknowledging the value of something. Read it in the dictionary. And we all do that with respect to what we think is really deep and important in life because it supports us and nurtures us. And if we go with it and are lucky, it will optimize our existence. Yeah, we really value that. We worship it. We write poems about it. Maybe we put them to music and then we sing hymns. The Communist International is just a hymn. Revelation. Everybody has got some privileged source of experience or knowledge about the so-called ground. Maybe it's the Delphic Oracle. Maybe it's Moses coming off the mountain. Maybe it's Jesus Christ. Maybe it's Muhammad. Maybe it's what happens to you when you do transcendental meditation and you experience yourself to be one with absolute reality. Maybe it's Karl Marx. Maybe it's Mao Zedong. Maybe it's Hitler's Mein Kampf. Maybe it's science textbooks. Maybe it's scientific methodology. But every human being privileges some kind of experience, some kind of source of knowledge, which tells them about this ground and its power to support life, to nurture life. So it's not just, you know, Christians and Muslims talking about special revelation. Science is special revelation. Marxist analysis is special revelation. New Age mysticism is special revelation. Your own experience is special revelation. If you're not going to believe anything that you haven't experienced and you can't accept in your mind, then, of course, your ego is the source of special revelation. 4, everybody's got doctrinal and moral truths and standards. Don't kill me is at the very least one. If there isn't any other moral principle in the world, it's, I mean, I'm okay, you ain't so hot. That would be your, you know, one of your basic doctrinal principles here. But for me, 2 thumbs up. And therefore, don't fuss with me. Don't take my rights away. Don't give me pain. You've got a morality there. It's not a very sophisticated one. It's not a very social one, but it's a morality. Nobody can deal without some doctrinal beliefs and without some moral beliefs. So, I mean, you might not like the ones of the Catholic Church or something like that, but it's not like you can get rid of them totally. You've got them too. This is universally human. Witch doctors have them. Shamans have them. New Agers have them. Wiccans have them. Everybody's got them. I think it's undeniable. 5, everybody's got a view of the good life. They've got some notion of what is wrong. And with life, not just what's morally wrong, but what's wrong with life. Nobody, I think, thinks that everything is just fine the way it is. Somebody walks up and steals your stuff, there's something wrong here. And something needs to be done. But everybody's got some diagnosis of what's wrong with human life. I mean, it's bad genes, bad socialization, failure of public education, not enough money, you name it. Everybody's got a diagnosis such that if we would fix that problem as the fundamental problem, life would get a whole lot better for everybody. So that's a doctrine of salvation, okay? It's not just Muslim or Christian or something. There's a doctrine of salvation in Nazism, a doctrine of salvation in Marxism, a doctrine of salvation in Bertrand Russell's scientific humanism. There it is. Furthermore, there are 6 required practices and lifestyles. People want it their way, but you can't just have it your way because you're not an absolute being. I mean, if you want, say, a lot of pleasure, then you have to have some affluence, unless, you know, introspection is a pleasure that you get, but not many people in our culture are interested in that. But I mean, if you, you know, sexual pleasure, You've got to be probably sexually attractive, or either that or you've got to have money to be able to buy it or something. You can't just will sexual pleasure. In order to get sexual pleasure, you've got to do some things. So every worldview has commandments. It's got things you've got to do. God says, keep my commandments and I'll bless you. Okay? Playboy philosophy. Keep my commandments and I will bless you. Communism, keep my commandments and I will bless you. Wicca, keep my commandments and I will bless you. That's just how it is in human life. I don't know if God exists or not at this point, but I'm just saying, whether he does or not, these are the structural dynamics of human existence, and they're pretty much universal. And finally, seven, you may not like church or synagogue or any of that kind of stuff, but humans are, most of them, except the extreme introverts, are social beings. And even even the introverts like to come out of the bathroom once in a while and sort of mix with other ones. And so people tend to hang around with kindred spirits, with folks who share their spirituality. So unless you're an absolute spiritual introvert, you're going to probably sometime or other associate with people like you. And now you're going to have, you're going to start your own church. If you meet together three times, you've already started a church. I don't care what it is. So you can be negative about the traditional church, but you can't totally get rid of this. This is a category that's intrinsic to human existence. The social, the collegial, the communal aspect of worldview havers. They get together. Well, I'm coming pretty close to the end here. Let me just run very quickly over Roman numeral 3 and 4, and then I'm going to come to Roman numeral 5, and we'll have a time of discussion. What kinds of worldviews are there? Well, I've been doing this as a philosopher of religion for decades, and so you develop a classification system, just like a biologist or a stamp collector or something like that. And I think there are basically three kinds of worldviews. There are the supernatural ones, that is to say, where this existential ground is something beyond the physical world. And there are those which are naturalistic. The ultimate ground is some dimension of this physical world, or maybe it's just the universe itself. And then the third one isn't about what is metaphysically ultimate, what was there first, God or the Big Bang kind of thing. Nobody thinks that humans are the primary reality. I guess a few humans do think they created everything else, but I mean, most of those are in mental institutions. But humanism is just the view, metaphysically, God may be there, or the Big Bang in the universe may be there, but let's face it, we are the ones, from our human point of view, that think about God. And we make up ideas about God. And so we try to live in terms of those ideas. Or we view the universe and we view it either as a mythical living being, or we view it as scientific materialists view it. But then we relate to it in terms of these human perceptions. So at the end, theology and religion is a human perception. And science or our views of the world is a human perception. And let's face it, we're on our own because even if God exists, we're the ones who are going to do theology and do ethics and go to church or not go to church. And so in the end, it's going to be up to us. We've got to save ourselves. We're constructing our own religions. We're evaluating our own worldviews. And that's what I mean by humanism. And then I give a whole list of things here: philosophy, science, political ideology, economic power, pleasure, one's own experience and judgment, altered or paranormal states, mysticism, drug use, that kind of stuff is a biggie for a lot of people. That's where your only comfort in life and in death is. That's where you finally hit nirvana, right? I mean, think about that. That's also a religious lifestyle. Even if it's an addiction, if you hate it, well, maybe it isn't. But if you're attracted to it and affirm it, well, then that's a kind of a worldview. But it's a kind of humanism, isn't it? And then finally, there are pluralist ones. So that would be the catalog of worldviews. And then I can give you the different types. But I haven't found one that doesn't fit into these categories yet. If you think you can come up with one, I'd be glad to add your category and give you a footnote the next time I write about it. Well, Roman numeral 4 is just the question of religious truth and pluralism here. The philosopher John Hick is the one who kind of comes up with these categories, and it's why philosophers who think about the fact of religious plurality discuss it in these terms. Religious pluralism is the view that we're all blind persons groping the elephant, right? I mean, you know that kind of a metaphor. And so we're all just got different parts of the elephant, and we're all fine, and it's all true, provided none of us says, this is the whole deal. The tail isn't the whole deal. The tusk isn't the whole deal. The stomach isn't the whole deal. And that's really a paradigm for the world religions, except that John Hick and the Hindu emperor know that it's an elephant. See, somebody knows that's the right point of view. And so that really folds into B, inclusivism, where one point of view, there's one right worldview in the end. But it's a generous one. And in terms of that one right worldview, we can see why all the other worldviews are blind men groping on the elephant. And so we can be inclusive of them. And we might even also be generous and say those folks, even though they don't know our right worldview, might benefit from salvation, whatever that is. So Hinduism would be glad to include Christians and Muslims and atheists. Christian inclusivists would be glad to include everybody else, but Christ is the only way. Baha'i would like to, you know, they start with Islam, but then they get rid of all the exclusive stuff, and then it's in terms of Baha'i's view of Allah that everybody else gets included. See, so that's, but don't forget, our religion is the one that kind of hits the bullseye. And then there's exclusive, and by the way, that works for secular views too. Marxism might be inclusive of other people, but only if it's generous, because otherwise it's exclusivism, like C. You go to a concentration camp if you're not a Marxist. You're liquidated if you're not a Nazi. And so it's not just religions like Christianity or Islam that say there are true believers and they make it and the other ones don't, because there are lots of secular worldviews that way too. If you're not really a scientific humanist, you're not going to get the benefits of scientific humanism. You're going to end up, you know, shipwrecking because you're still religious or something like that. So exclusivism is not just for, you know, religious fundamentalism. There's exclusivism throughout all the secular worldviews as well. So those are the views, but as a Christian, I'm going to say Roman numeral 5. I think in the first place, there are many good principles, values, and practices in postmodern spirituality. I'm not simply going to pan this. The authentic seeking, the desire for relevance, for stuff that really works in life, the desire for authentic community and not sheer formalism or institutionalism or ritualism, these are all very valuable things. Worry about over strict paradigms. I mean, Christianity's got a lot of problems. I mean, if you're not Reformed, you ain't a real Christian. If you're not Catholic, you're not a real Christian. If you don't do it our way, the religions. What is it? Is it Sufi Islam or Sunni Islam or Shiite Islam? And some of those people will kill one another. So there's a worry about hegemonic meta-narratives, as some of the French philosophers will say, totalitarian views. If you don't believe it our way, out. You're not welcome here. And there's a lot of good concern in postmodernism about that kind of thing. Secondly, Christianity does have a problem with axiomatic pluralism or relativism about ultimate truth and reality. Christianity, look, the triune God, incarnate in Jesus Christ, creator of the world, savior of the world, there is no way to the Father except through Christ. Now, God may be very generous on Judgment Day. That's a different issue. But we're not talking about, oh, well, you know, maybe it's Christ for the Christians and Muhammad for the Muslims, and no. Then there's just one way, and so there is a true meta narrative. But see, the biggest problem that I think Christians and people of other religions too would have with postmodernism is that postmodern spirituality, like all human religions, is a human construction. I've come at this, as it were, from below. I've come out of this by way of describing human behavior and human need. And so far, I've described the worldviews as humans finding ways, perhaps imaginatively projecting ways, of answering their questions about satisfying their basic needs. So by that definition, Christianity could be just the projection of some folks that knew Jesus. Maybe Islam is just the projection of some Arabs who knew Muhammad. Maybe the Quran was just something that Muhammad made up. Just like Marxism is the projection of Karl Marx. And you see what I'm saying, huh? But in the end, Christianity says, no. Christianity says, right, all of you folks are full of existential need, and you need answers not only to your big questions, but you need some power to ground your existence and to support you and to take care of whatever is fundamentally wrong with human existence and make it right so that you can flourish. And Christianity doesn't think that this is just something that humans made up, that Jesus followers made up. We think that it comes from God, and so that God himself has reached down into history and come taken on our nature in Jesus Christ and then left a witness about this in Holy Scripture, so that the Christian religion is, as it were, God's gift to fill this existential void, to answer the existential quest. And so Christianity does think there's an ultimate objective truth. And finally, biblical Christianity affirms basic biblical truths about God, salvation, and right living as universally human. So we don't think all truth is relative. We don't think all truth is culturally constructed. But on the other hand, I think it's important that Christians stick in general with mere Christianity. I mean, I'm in one denomination and not another, and I understand the reasons for this, but for me, that's not an ultimate thing. The ultimate thing is the gospel. The ultimate thing is Jesus Christ. That's what C.S. Lewis calls mere Christianity, and that would include folks from lots of different denominations, and we would put aside our quibbles about this and that and the other thing, because in the end, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter for life, and it certainly does not matter for the afterlife, those kinds of things. I'm not saying that's not important, but I'm saying Christianity, in the context of postmodern spirituality, has to insist on some basic universal truths, but it is also very pliable, very contextualizable. And the history of Christianity is not just a history of cultural imperialism and disaster, but actually the Christian church, since the first century, has flourished in many different cultures. It has satisfied many different people with many different personality types and that sort of thing. And to this day, Christianity is still the fastest growing religion in the world. All right, enough already. I'd only talked 10 minutes past my allotted time. Who wants to take the first shot? Or make the first nice comment? Ken.
We hear a lot about interfaith dialogue.
Yeah. Very much. I mean, the fact that there are multiple religions and worldviews is indisputable. What are we going to do about it? And I think interreligious dialogue is really important, and I actually participate in it. I mean, we have a West Michigan interfaith dialogue, and I go to that thing practically every year, and I offer papers and stuff like that, sit down with folks of other faith, just to get to know them as individuals, but also to understand better what they believe. If I sit down with an Islamic mullah and ask him some questions, suppose we've got a positive relationship where we can have an honest and frank dialogue, I learn a whole lot more, at least about his version of Islam, than I do listening to newspapers or reading books about Islam by hostile Christians or any of this kind of stuff. It's really important that we know what one another believe, even if what they believe is that we really don't have any religious rights. I want to hear that from them. I want to get that right. And so I think it's really important. But once again, there are different interpretations about what's going on. Some people participate in religious dialogue because they're pluralists in John Hick's sense. I don't. Some people participate because they're inclusivists in John Hick's sense. I don't participate that way. I am a religious exclusivist, and it's not me. It's because I think, you know, the Christian religion says there's no way to the Father except through the Son, and that's Jesus Christ. Maybe God hears everybody's prayer, in the sense that he knows everybody's prayer, but the way to the Father, the right way to the Father, is through Christ, and that's what Christianity teaches, and it's not my right to change that if that's what the religion is all about. On the other hand, I want everybody to be included. I would love it if on the judgment day, it turns out God's more generous than some Christians think that he is. I mean, if it's up to God, which is what Calvinism believes anyway, then maybe God's going to, and it's surely up to his grace and not what anything humans, like what humans believe or what they do, maybe in the end God could be more generous than some Christians think he is. But that's up to God. You know, so God is the judge and God is the savior, but I still believe that when I go into religious dialogue. Who knows what's going to happen as a result of a dialogue? Maybe we just understand one another better. Maybe that person becomes interested in Christianity. Maybe some negative feelings about Christianity are dispelled because of my participation in this. And who knows what God does that with that in the long run. So maybe it would, maybe the person would come to Christianity, maybe not, but that's up to God in the end. And so I think religious, we really ought to engage in interreligious dialogue, and we can do that without giving up our own religious beliefs. I don't give up my religious beliefs when I go in there. I want to be respected, and I respect in turn, and I just leave it up to God to see what happens as a result of the dialogue. I do have a problem with interreligious worship, though. That I don't do. Yes, ma'am.
When you say God might be more generous on Judgment Day than what we, at least what I believe when I say that Jesus is the way to the Father, and I heard you say that too. Can you say, tell us more about what that statement means, God might be more generous?
Well, sure. Christ could be the only way, okay, the only source of salvation for humans. But in an awful lot of Christianity, I mean, the grace that brings salvation is God's gift through Christ, which is given to human beings, but it's not given to human beings because they're good or because they believe the right things or because this or that or the other thing, at least in my brand, Augustinian Reformed brand of Christianity. Now, if that's the case, then it would be perfectly possible for God to say, you know what, your Frisian ancestors 1,000 years ago, that was before the gospel got there. They were worshiping trees and dancing painted blue and scaring the life out of the Roman legions and stuff like this. Caesar mentions the Frisians, by the way. What if God would, in his grace, decide to save those people? What if the Holy Spirit went to those people in terms of their religion, and some of those people knew that they were toast without the power that was in the tree or something like this, and they really did want to worship it? I can't put people in heaven. I don't know if there's a second chance after you die or not. All I know is this, that the one who judges on Judgment Day is Christ. It's God, and God will save whom he wills. And you know, the way is, of course, you should respond to the gospel, you should follow Jesus and stuff like this. But some Christians think that unless you've done that and are really sincere about it, you're going to hell forever. And I guess I don't believe that. I'm not a universalist. Everybody's saved. It's up to God. It's up to God's grace. It's not up to me. I can never talk to another living human being and say, you're going to hell. Because 5 minutes later, that person could be converted to Jesus, and I just told a brother or sister, you're going to hell. I can't do that. I'm an Orthodox Calvinist, okay? But I don't want to get into that so much, Orthodox Calvinism or that sort of thing. I mean, the conversation ought to be broader, but that's what I meant by my statement. And a bunch of other Reformed theologians have said that too, by the way. I'm not saying they're in. I'm saying I have no right to put them out because God decides. God will never throw out somebody who trusts in him and looks to him for salvation. That you don't have to worry about. But could he be generous to the folks who maybe even never heard Jesus? Or because their lives were so twisted and goofed up, subjectively, they never had any chance to come to faith and stuff like this. I mean, why not? Would a generous God be open to those folks? Why not? But I don't know. That's my attitude, okay? Yes, sir.
I don't see how you can be a real postmodernist without being a pluralist. You do have some negative beliefs about objective universal truth and that sort of thing, but those are mostly negative beliefs. But even postmodernism is not one thing. As far as I, the philosophy textbooks will give you six kinds of postmodernism. And then, things that grow up and call themselves as postmodernism. Neo-romanticism is postmodernism. It's the happy, give all the kids a Coke and they'll have the United Nations group on sort of stuff. But Nietzsche's postmodernism is everybody is at war with everybody else. So angry tribalists and angry racists and angry feminists and all that other kind of stuff would be a kind of a negative postmodernism. Everybody's got their own ideology and their interests, and there is no plain way it is all together. The global village is an impossibility. So survive. That's a kind of negative postmodernism. It's not just one thing. But they're all pluralists.
Have there been surveys done to determine what percentage of people in the world or in Michigan or in the U.S. are pluralists?
Well, there are lots of pluralists in the sense of recognizing that there's just a plurality of beliefs around. I mean, I think almost 100% of the population is that way. But I know that Barnes and other people, they do polls, religious polls, worldview polls, that sort of thing. There's a lot of people who are not simply postmodern pluralists. In fact, there's a very strong belief among Europeans and North Americans, which looks like a kind of a moralistic deism. That is to say, there is a God. And the God created the world, maybe had us evolve out of it. The God does want us all to get along. Can't you guys just get along? And there's an afterlife. And people who just all try to get along do well in the afterlife. And people who really don't care don't. But it's not a question of going to church or confessing your sins on Sunday and then going out and just not loving other people. It's this kind of global love that God is interested in. But that's Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. That's Voltaire. That's Rousseau. That's Immanuel Kant. Thomas Jefferson. Benjamin Franklin. If Jesus is important, maybe he was a really good guy that you follow. If you want to think that God was specially in him somehow, maybe that's okay, but that kind of stuff doesn't matter. And a great deal, as I said, the European population still believe this. They're not atheists. They don't go to church. They're not Christians. And they sure don't want to become fundamentalist Muslims. But the Europeans believe in God, if that means some sort of a moral life force that permeates the universe and might even give some kind of an afterlife. A whole lot of people believe in that. Liberal Christians believe in that. Liberal Muslims believe in that. University professors who wouldn't bark at the door of the church believe in that. That is still a kind of dominant religion. And isn't it interesting that it's been around since the 17th century? It's the lowest common denominator, personal moralism of God. And by that, God doesn't do any magic tricks, like supernatural healings or resurrections or that kind of stuff. don't be believing all those supernatural miracles in the Bible. You would need to demythologize those kinds of things. But there is God, and I think Tillich and Oakmont, I mean, a lot of liberal 20th century theologians believe that kind of stuff. But so do a lot of other well-educated people in the world, corporate heads, people way up in the United Nations, they believe that. And they try to live that morally. But that's America, isn't it? In God we trust, not Dolly. You can find God anyway, please. Well, we believe him. We're American. Yes, sir.
So isn't it all rather just futile in postmodernism? And to begin with, to reject the universal truth claim, it's itself the universal truth claim.
Well, it is.
But beyond that, everything you say about postmodernism, where they're rejecting everything, they basically are reconstructing it all on their own terms. So they haven't really rejected anything in the end. They're just constructing the same thing again under their own terms.
Yeah. So, yeah. Fundamentally, postmodernism is a negative thing. It doesn't like universal truth, whether metaphysical truth, religious truth, moral truth, because it really is in favor of everybody. You know, we're all entitled to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness any way we define it. And that was God's job to create the world, let us give us those fundamental rights, huh? Declaration of Independence. And so we just take that literally, and now we really do take this God-given right to construct and pursue life, liberty, and pursue happiness any way we please. And it really is just that. But because you're absolutely right. I mean, as a rational position, it's self-refuting. As Socrates pointed out, a long time before Jesus was born, that relativism is self-refuting because it's an absolute claim. And anyway, so, right, that's often sophomores in high school figure that out. And so, right at that point, they're not going to turn out to be postmodernists. But the fact is, postmodernism as a philosophical movement flourished maybe in the 60s and 70s into the 80s. But philosophically, I mean, it's not a movement because it's just critical thinking about everything. And critical thinking can deconstruct anything. So then there's nothing left. But philosophy wants to construct some stuff. And so what we have now is a whole bunch of returns to older philosophical views. We're back to neo-scientific humanism. And you would know that, you're a scientist, okay? But we're back to neo-romanticism. We're back to neo-deism. We're back to neo-pragmatism. Richard Rorty was a pragmatist, wrote his dissertation. He's a big postmodern philosopher. Gave up philosophy and became a comparative literature teacher, because that's all it is. Just a bunch of different texts. So Rorty is a neo-pragmatist. And it's, so now, postmodernism isn't really like a positive creed for life. It's just a deconstruction of all creeds for life, but we can't live that way. And so what's happening in the intellectual world is the resurgence of these other views. I mean, why do you think that sociobiology is coming back? I thought modernism was dead. Modernism is not dead. Sociobiology is just scientific is modern humanism all over again. Rorty and those kind of people. So you kick out a demon, and seven come back and fill the house. And postmodernism kicked out the demons of traditional religion, absolute truth claims, but also the absolute rules. And if the individual rules don't like it, so much the worse for them. And, you know, if they fight, okay, then they get to be the alpha male. But that's how society works. But meanwhile, we have authority, we have rules. And it might not be objectively morally wrong to bust the rules, like God would be displeased with you, but those rules are there for the flourishing of life. And we want to live, be alive. That's what biological drive to survive. And so if you're behaving in such a way that our collective survival gets undermined, we can give you a timeout, or we can hang you by the neck until you're dead, or something like that. And now, recently, there's a really interesting stuff in evolutionary biology about altruism among animals. You know, if you give a rat, make a rat really hungry, and then give a rat some sugar water, but there's another rat right next to him, and this rat's also very hungry, and this rat can tell that this rat is really hungry. This rat is not going to simply go to the sugar water and keep it selfishly. This rat is going to share with this rat. They've done it with rats. They've done it with monkeys and chimpanzees. So now the argument is, you don't need to love Jesus to be altruistic. It's in your genes. And so we've got to do unto others as you'd like them to do unto you. It's wired into your biology. Well, maybe it is. I mean, if body and soul are kind of integrated, and that is the law of love in terms of which we were created in the beginning, maybe that's not totally wrong. Maybe that's not totally wrong. But then it would be the result of an intelligent design. It just happened. Don't go too quickly for the claim that if you don't have God, you can't have an objective moral order, because that's just false. There have been lots of examples in history of philosophers who have given us pretty solid, I mean, it's not genuinely moral. It's always some kind of pragmatism. It's social pragmatism. It's always payoff. I mean, following the rule is not justified in terms of right and wrong. Following the rule is justified in terms of optimal outcomes, good outcomes and bad outcomes. But there's still rules, and they're clear, and you can hold people responsible in terms of them in such a way that there can be punishments and rewards and stuff like that for bad and good behavior. So it's just not true in terms of worldviews that you have to have a person who walk in any kind of God to get an objective moral system. Aristotle's God wasn't personal or moral. But Aristotle is the guy who started the notion of natural law. The Stoic God is pantheism. Stoic God wasn't either moral or rational or personal or in a sense, but Stoicism also had a moral order which was called the natural law. And it's built into the work and move of your nature to be a moral being. And that's a very good question. Yes, sir.
Talking a little bit earlier about how relativism, you know, is kind of self-refuting and almost makes it impossible to really believe it as a, you know, sort of absolute. And, I don't know, on some grounds it seems like it's almost, it's, I don't know, maybe
so what comes into my subjectivity is sufficient reason to suppose that maybe I'm not alone in the world, and if other folks are like me, and if I've got a lot of value, then they've got a lot of value, if I've got thoughts and feelings, and they've got thoughts and feelings, and you have within subjectivity the capacity not to be a subjectivist. And then if you look out, you notice that there's a natural world, and there's other folks, and maybe some of the ways and some of the structures in terms of which we relate are not just natural scientific structures, but these are oughts. Ought. Maybe that's another thing. And then maybe we can sort of wonder where this all comes from. And so inside of subjectivity, we start wondering about spirituality. We start wondering, is there just one way things are? Or is there multiple universes, and where they overlap, and who knows, so there just isn't one way that things are? So I want to acknowledge subjectivity. It's really important. But I think it's a terrible mistake to move from subjectivity to subjectivism when inside of subjectivity there's good and sufficient reason to deny subjectivism. I can't change the law of gravity by willing it. I can't. There's a terrific amount about reality that I can't change by willing it. I'm sorry, I'm going to be 65 years old this year. I would love to just truly believe that I'm 45, and then I will be 45. I'm going to construct reality the way I want it. And the arthritis that's starting in your shoulder, and you see what I'm saying? There's, in my subjectivity, there's so little over which I have any arbitrary control that turning to some worldview in terms of which my desires and needs sort of shape or create reality, it just looks like it's a kind of irrational project. It's not just a bad religious project. It looks to me like it's unreasonable. So, I mean, I'm not suggesting that you were in favor of subjectivism, but I really do want to make this point, because modern philosophy gets off into that trip. Descartes starts with cogito. Okay, Descartes, the first thing he does is prove God's existence so that what he's experiencing is objectively true, and Descartes turns out to be an Augustinian Christian in the end. And this is just where he starts, but he knows he's got to move to God, and God then is what guarantees the objective truth that his subjective mind knows. But as soon as you cut God away, then you end up with David Hume, and all you have is experience. And if all you have is human experience, and everything that you know, math and logic and morals and religion and everything else is just a function of human experience, now you've got subjectivism. David Hume, 1750. So maybe postmodernism started in 1750. That's subjectivism, but subjectivism is not entailed in any way by the fact that we all have to start from subjectivity. Fair enough?
Yeah. What's the appropriate position on certainty? How certain? I mean, I see subjectivism as, you know, you're saying there are certain things that you need to sort of make ought decisions about, ethical decisions about. We can't just be relativistic in that realm. Subjectivity, as it's sort of, I don't know, universally acknowledged, might still impact how sure you can be about the nature of objective reality.
Yeah, but once again, it's reality itself that might make available different grades of certainty. We all love to have mathematical certainty, huh? I mean, one is one, whether God exists or not. That's pretty certain. Math and logic have this absolute certainty about them. A little less certain than that is what we learn inductively from science or experience. Inductive logic doesn't give us certainty, it just gives us degrees of probability. But that works really nice in science or in some other controlled experience, but what about in everyday life? Huh? Are you sure that the person you ask to marry is in love with you? Well, she says so, and the behavior seems to carry that out. But now we're in the realm of practical certainty. When you serve on a jury and you see the evidence that so-and-so is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, there are times when it's appropriate to withhold judgment, where the jury ought to be hung, where the jury ought to acquit, because there is not certain beyond a reasonable doubt. But there are times to what's available to me. And it's the same in religion.
You don't have evidence.
Well, evidence, how do you define that? I mean, if when you read scripture or when you pray to God, something really powerful happens to you, and it just seems to you that this isn't just your excitement, but that God's talking to you, is that not pretty strong evidence for the fact that God is? And unless you have a defeater of that, wouldn't that be pretty strong religious experience as an evidence for the truth of what it is you believe? I think so. So does William James. So there's quite a few philosophers. But of course, I may be certain about something and might still be wrong. So we were not. But it seems to me to be perfectly rational when I have an overwhelming kind of experience about something, and I look at that experience, what it might be, and it keeps on pointing to a certain kind of thing, and then I don't have any defeaters or even any underminers of that kind of thing. It just looks to me crazy. Say, well, boy, I don't know if that's true or not. People aren't wired that way. We're not just mathematicians and scientists. We're existential beings. And as existential beings, there's a whole lot of experience and evidence and stuff like that which rationally justifies, if not with not mathematical certainty, but existential certainty, a sort of certainty which gets people to voluntarily be martyrs. Very few mathematicians have martyred themselves to defend their theorems. Whether it's true or not, there are bombers who are willing to be martyrs because they have another kind of certainty. Doesn't follow from the fact that you're certain that it's true. But when you talk about certainty, don't just define it in a very rationalistic way. Fair enough? Because it's not human. We can't live in the world if mathematical and scientific certainty are the only kinds of certainty. And I got a lot of philosophers on my side. Kant.
That's all just your opinion.
Yeah. I hope you guys are feeling good.
No, thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. Okay. Jeff is going to stay a little longer. I encourage you to continue the conversation with them. We have refreshments in the back. Also, I encourage you to continue the conversation here at Fellowship Church on Sundays at 10:30. And with our